to Real World Rewind, a monthly podcast where we take a look back at some of our favorite movies from years gone by, reminding ourselves that entertainment is not mindless. I'm one of your hosts, Shannon Grimes, and today joining me is the one and only Blaine Grimes.
I live my life a quarter mile at a time. Nothing else matters.
No, it doesn't.
Hi.
This month on Real World Rewind, to continue our recent trend of reviewing films that are related to contemporary releases, we're taking a look back at The Fast and Furious, the original, the film that sparked a franchise whose most recent installment is The Fate of the Furious.
The Fast and the Furious, as we're saying it now, was released in 2001. It was directed by Rob Cohen, who also helmed Dragonheart and Triple X. It was written by Gary Scott Thompson, Eric Bergquist, and David Ayer, actually. David Ayer, who is now better known as the director of End of Watch, Suicide Squad, and Fury. So there's an interesting little connection there. And the film stars the late Paul Walker, Vin Diesel, Michelle Rodriguez, Jordana Brewster, and many, many more. Quite a cast we have in this film.
Eclectic.
Yeah. So maybe the best way to start our discussion about The Fast and the Furious is by talking about how watching this movie most recently, actually not that long ago today for us, was literally a blast from the past. There were all sorts. I mean, we were pretty young when
I was in second grade.
Ooh, wow. That makes even me feel old. So that's crazy. I don't remember how old I was. I do remember the scene
with... I was
with,
in second grade. You would have been in fifth grade.
Yeah, fifth, sixth grade. That sounds about right. I do remember the scene with the car going under the semi-truck was a big deal. All the guys in school were talking about it
when the movie came out. I hadn't heard of any of these movies till I was, in college. So that meant nothing to me when
yeah.
I was little.
So for me, it kind of takes me back to those specific memories of everybody was talking about how, oh, it wasn't possible to do that, or it was possible to do that, or, oh, my dad has done that before, or something, you know, all these things. But also, there's just a lot of really, I don't know, fun things that I think brought us back to our childhood. Like, in the opening scene, VHS-TV combos.
Because that was the big money that you've got to steal right there, the VHSs.
Yes, you gotta get a lot of, although I think they do save their DVD players. I think they mentioned that in the film, even though they sure look like the VHS.
Really? Did they TV have DVDs then?
I think they did. But I guess that would have been more money because DVDs would have been more cutting edge then, certainly. But yeah, you got those big combo players, which is pretty funny, and cathode ray tube style TVs. And then, you've got, some great fashion. You were the fashion expert. Can you comment on the fashion in this?
Yeah, no, it wasn't great. It was terrible. It was so horrible. Because there's 90s fashion, the stuff that kids went to school in, and you know, the windbreakers and, elastic pants and straight leg jeans and stuff. Like, that was bad 90s fashion. But this was, like skimpy 90s fashion that was little triangle shirts that weren't shirts and leather mini skirts and pumps with jewels on them. Bejeweled clothing, y'all. Do you remember when we bejeweled our clothing? This was bad.
And then, so yeah, there's your fashion analysis there. There's also a great line. One of the police officers at one point says to Brian, he says, you know, Brian's like, I need more time, because they always need more time in these movies to do whatever they're going to do. And the cop says, if you want time, buy the magazine.
It took Blaine a minute to process that. I was laughing from the get-go there.
And so it's funny because, I mean, obviously Time Magazine is still around, but I should have looked this up, but I don't think they're doing print anymore. I think that was a big news story, is that they're not doing print anymore. But I mean, at any rate, I mean, tons of magazines aren't existing in print, don't exist in print anymore. Everything's
true,
digital.
True.
So, I mean, print magazines, that was a thing all the way back in 2001. Speaking of print and things being in physical form, you caught this little gem in the third act of the film when they're in a race.
Yeah, instead of texting and driving, he grabs the map from his girl and starts, you know, looking at the map. The map, while he's behind the wheel, because it's a paper road map like we used to take on our road trips. No GPS here.
You just adore the Explorer inside Fast and the Furious. It's like Inception, movie Inception, speaking of Blast from the Past. But yeah,
Let's see if we can find Boots. Maybe he's hiding somewhere.
A paper map. Of all things. So yeah, it was a lot of fun to watch this movie again, just because it brought back a lot of memories, and there was a lot of fun stuff to catch. So it was quite a bit of fun. But as we're starting to discuss this, to be perfectly honest, this film, The Fast and the Furious, and all of the others in the series, they're really not my cup of tea. And if you know me at all, you know that's probably not a surprise to you. But whether it's my cup of tea or not, we're still here to talk about these movies. And obviously, this film struck a chord with a pretty broad audience. I mean, it made over $207 million on a $38 million budget. And, of course, it did, like Shannon mentioned in the intro, it kicked off the series. And the series is still going strong. I mean, as we're recording, this is the weekend that the fate of the Furious just opened. So I mean,
did it open today?
Yeah, officially. And I guess there were you know, Thursday previews or whatever.
Y'all can go see it after we rave about this
one. No, anybody who's a huge fan of this is going to see it opening night or something like that. They'll have already seen it.
We
haven't seen it yet. And we might.
We may not.
We might or we might not. But nevertheless, the movie did do very well, and it struck a chord with a lot of people. So I think anytime you have a movie or a series of movies that does that, whether or not it's your cup of tea, I think we can talk about these movies and deal with them honestly and openly. And so maybe we can talk a little bit about why these films are so popular. And there are a number of reasons. We're going to highlight a few. And I think ultimately, just to put everything under a very broad umbrella, it's because these films are very populist movies. And I don't mean that in a derogatory way at all, but these are movies that are made to appeal to the broadest audience possible. And in a
hot
sense,
guys, yeah. Pretty girls blow stuff up.
There you go.
There you go.
And in a sense, all blockbusters do that, but these certainly do that in a way that seems to hit home with a lot of people. And we'll see if we can tease out some of why that might be. I also think the narrative itself, the story of The Fast and the Furious, especially this first one, really puts some significant emphasis or some notable emphasis on blue-collar versus white-collar conflict. There seems to be a decent bit of that going on. Also, confession, we're talking about this. I have seen, I can't remember for sure if I've seen all of the other Fast and the Furious movies, aside from The Fate of the Furious, but I've seen quite a few of them, but it's been a while, so I apologize to anyone who's listening who's a big fan, because I'm terrible with character names and I forget the character's overall arc and all of that stuff. So we really are going to be talking about this movie as an isolated film, probably as much as possible. But nevertheless, this movie puts a lot of emphasis on blue collar versus white collar conflict, or you could call it, underdog versus favorite sort of clashes. Where are some places that we see that? Because you saw some interesting things in regard to that, Shannon.
Well, I mean, it's interesting to me the way that at the very beginning of the film, all the other racers are referring to Brian, you know, as like, oh, that white kid, like, he's so white, he just does white people things. And then by the end of the movie, you know, they kind of drop it and he's like over there making fun of other white people who are racing in their rich Ferraris and stuff, which, you know, is big, like, stereotypes of things. But
yeah, it could have been better if he was in a Hummer, but I guess you can't really race him.
I don't know if Hummers were out then. That may not have been a thing yet.
But yeah, so that Ferrari race is a big deal, obviously, because it's, you know, this very, like, I'm also not a huge car guy, so I apologize to anyone anyone else who listens who's a huge car guy. I used to watch NASCAR a lot as a kid, but I've fallen off of that. I'm going to talk about cars like a 5-year-old maybe. But obviously a Ferrari is sort of it's an upper class car. It's expensive. And really what it seems like to the untrained eye is that Toretto and his group, like, they work on cars that are, they don't cost as much, but they've got good
engines.
They beef them up.
They have good innards.
They beef them up so that they are better cars, right? Than it would at first appearance, right? It's what's under the surface that matters.
To become a, quote, 10-second car, which I had to use context clues to figure that one out. But
So that race with the Ferrari there, it's you know, these people who are in you know, who are more blue-collar workers are able to best the white-collar, like, yuppie or whatever. It's also the fact that all of these characters in the film are mechanics or skilled laborers.
They know their stuff.
Yeah,
they, like, work with their hands and.
But it's not like it's not like one of them is a Harvard professor who, you know, who just does this and is, you know, who steals stuff and whatnot in his spare time.
No Walter Whites here.
Yeah. So all of these characters are very working class characters. And then, of course, it's playing off of this idea that we see in a lot of these kinds of movies where there's at least one character in this movie. It's Jesse, who provides, you know, a little bit of emotional boost in this film at the end. But he's very smart.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's Brian who says to him at one point, he's like, you should go to MIT.
And he's like, oh no, I have that attention thing, ADD,
yeah.
And so I can't because I flunked out of high school, which is sad.
Yeah. So it's there it is. It's you know, it's upper class versus lower class. Like he's not able to fit into the system because he can't cut it in a certain area because he has this problem or something like that. But he's still good enough, right?
Yeah.
Or better, even in some cases.
I guess at that time, well, I don't really know, but I think at that time, like, ADD wasn't something that was as broadly normalized as it is now. And so probably being, like, having that condition would have othered you in the situation of being, you know, at a place like MIT, whereas now it's really not a problem.
There you go. Nursing. Shannon is a registered nurse or an LVN. So yeah, bring a little medical experience into there. So that was interesting. I had not thought of that at all. The narrative puts a lot of emphasis on, you know, class relations, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. That's certainly something that I think gives a film a broad appeal, because the upper class is not the majority. That's why they're called the upper class. That's why they're called the 1%, or, you know, whatever. And so this movie has that broader appeal because of that. And again, I'm not saying that it's populist or anything as a criticism of the film by any means. But the movie also, in addition to this, it plays off of a lot of familiar tropes and themes that we see in many other films. So why don't you pick one way that it does this?
Oh, well, the one that I thought of, so I'll go with this, is that it kind of reminded me of West Side Story, where you have, you know, two worlds colliding. You have the tough crowd, which in this movie is obviously the racers, and then you have the preppier crowd, which in this movie is the cops, and then, you know, one kind of outsider from both groups. One of the outsiders from both the groups falls in love, and they have to figure out a way to work everything out, and someone ends up getting killed, but in this case it's not Tony or Maria.
But they do break out into dance at a couple points in the movie, right? And a guy shows off some, like, mad yo-yo skills.
Oh, yeah, that was very 2000s, like, glow in the dark yo-yo tricks at an adult party. That was fresh.
So West Side Story, I mean, you can look at this movie as, if you wanted to, as a romance, and of course it has that appeal built into it. The romance itself causes, like, that familial conflict that adds a little bit of extra, you know, tension to the story. And ultimately, like, at its heart, it's about an outsider who's trying to make his way inside a diverse team. So he's making his way into this team, and of course he falls in love with not just her, but actually he he really comes to love all of them, as we see by the end of the film, and he's willing to sort of let Toretto go, let him escape. And so it's got that at the heart of it, and that's a familiar narrative trope that we see come up again and again and again. And it's also this idea that, I mean, Brian, does it mention, he mentions his past, right?
Oh, well, I mean, Brian says that he did time for stealing cars, but I don't know, that could have been part of his cover. Like, the cops may have put that online as part of his cover. That may not have actually been him.
Oh, yeah.
I don't really know.
Yeah. At least when we buy it at that early point in the narrative, if you're seeing it for the first time, you know, it's also got that idea of, you know, you've got this protagonist with a shady past.
Toretto, like, really does have a shady Toretto past. He's your second protagonist.
Yeah, sure. Toretto really does. And then even when you get past that whole thing and you learn that Brian is actually a police officer, that's still, in a sense, in terms of the narrative, a shady past, because he's infiltrating this group and he's betraying their trust, which, as we'll talk about, it's a big deal in this movie. It's kind of a big deal. And I was thinking, as I was watching it this time, just kind of messing around, I was saying this is basically a samurai movie. And in a sense, because of the kinds of tropes that it plays off of, it does seem like it owes a bit to samurai films, to Kurosawa samurai films, for instance. Kurosawa's almost a Dirty Dozen. Seven Samurai.
Oh.
Yeah, the Magnificent Seven's a remake. But Kurosawa's Seven Samurai was really one of the first movies where you've got this whole, hey, let's get the gang together and do a thing kind of movie. And then, of course, it got played off of in the...
Do a thing. We're going to do a thing.
It got played off of in the Western genre from that point on. And so you've got that spirit here in this movie where you've got Toretto's group. You could basically see them as a samurai clan. And of course, Toretto is the samurai lord there. He's the very wise master who's everything. He's the Yoda.
He's sensei.
He's the sensei. I like to think of him as the...
I don't know if that's a samurai thing. I think it's a karate thing.
Yeah. He's like sexy Yoda.
Oh, I don't know about that.
But Toretto is very clearly this leader. Also, if we're looking at this as a samurai movie, and one of the things that made me think of it as a samurai movie is the clan, if you will, the Toretto clan, operates on an honor and loyalty code more than they do any sort of, you know, capitalist financial mode. And again, that ties back into the upper class versus lower class thing. But respect and honor, honor and loyalty.
You will bring honor to us all.
That's a big deal. That's a big deal in this movie. Respect is more important than money. One of the first ways Brian sort of gets his foot in the door in that first race when he meets Toretto is he says, look, I'm going to do this race. And if I win, I get your respect and the money or something like that. But he basically says respect is more important than the money or something like that. Maybe he just gets the respect if he wins. I forget how it is. But that's the first thing that, you know, kind of makes Toretto see, hey, you know, respect. This is important. Honor. This is important. So many times in this movie, like, they say something like, you know,
you disrespected me. You embarrassed me. You disrespected my family. My family. Honor is gone.
I was expecting you to go into a Zootopia quote.
Oh, man, I should have prepared. So, anyways, imagine Mr. Big saying this. If you haven't seen Zootopia, turn off this podcast and go see it.
So, yeah, it could also be a Godfather movie. instead of sword fights, this movie has car battles.
It's like the Italian mob, but it's in California with cars.
Yeah, maybe that's one reason this movie doesn't appeal to me personally as much, just because I like sword fights instead of car battles, because cars don't do a lot for me. But apparently, judging from the way people talk about cars and objectify cars like women in this movie, I guess cars do a lot for some people, so that's your thing. But yeah, so you got this samurai thing. But like you mentioned, Shannon, you could plug any number of narrative styles in this movie. You could do, you know, West Side Story. We mentioned Pocahontas. There's also like a Viking ethic in some of these It was almost a Viking movie after some of these races, because it's like
really bad is what it was.
Because one of them's it's when the character goes up and he's like, the girl's like, you can have me if and the money if you win this or something like that. It's like, so you know,
that's, and then like he doesn't win and she's like, I don't want you, I want the guy that won.
Yeah,
it's like natural selection for cars. Right.
So, I mean, you could plug any number of narrative styles into this movie. And this, I think, relates to something that I've been thinking about and talking about a little bit even on my personal Facebook and Twitter feeds recently. And it relates to this idea of the monomyth, which was developed by Joseph Campbell primarily. It's also known as the hero's journey. It's probably more popularly known as the hero's journey. And so a lot of this that we've been doing when we talk about, it's this kind of movie and it fits into these tropes, that's monomyth type stuff, even though if we're not necessarily identifying the steps of the hero's journey in particular. And I've mentioned in some of my comments and some of my writing on Facebook and on Twitter, how oftentimes it seems like in film criticism anymore, there's this trend where we take a movie and we analyze it using the monomyth or the hero's journey.
Why don't you say a little bit more about that for people that don't know what that is?
Well, so the idea...
Five sentences or less.
The idea of the monomyth is it's a way of identifying story structure that is common among different cultures. So it's trying to identify major tent poles or plot points, if I could even put it like that, that are common throughout stories of various different cultures. So it's like, you know, the hero's call to action, the hero rejects the call, right?
Like a universal truth kind of?
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Okay. These are universal storytelling rules to very, very much simplify it.
Got it.
But one of the problems with just doing that, with just saying, okay, so this movie fits into all these tropes and it lines up with the monomyth, is that it doesn't encourage you to see what is different about the story that you're analyzing. Right, so we could spend this entire podcast saying, well, this movie is this movie, and it's that movie, and it's that movie. But that doesn't really tell us what's important about The Fast and the Furious, why The Fast and the Furious sparked a series. So it's good. The monomyth is good. The hero's journey is good because it can help us see how stories are similar. But you got to go past that, and we've got to try to figure out what exactly it is about The Fast and the Furious, maybe, that specifically that makes it an interesting story. So maybe we can try to do that. I think, as Shannon and I were talking about this after the movie, I think we both think that the Fast and the Furious, this film, and I would say the series as a whole, taps into our fundamental human need or desire to live in community. Okay? It shows that humans have a fundamental need or desire to live in a community, and it shows the power of family, community. So let's dig a little bit deeper into this family or community theme that runs throughout the movie and then really the entire series. So Shannon, why don't you, I talked for a while, so why don't you kick us off?
Cool. It's obvious if you watch the movie that family is very important in this movie, because there's the two types of family. There's biological family, and then there's the family that you create based on friends who you love and who, you know, love similar things, and just the people that you spend time with. And Ragtag, is that the phrase?
Yeah.
The ragtag team here is a family because, you know, they spend all their time together. They eat family meals together and they pray sort of together. And, you know, they all like have, they live, I think, in the same house, or at least they spend a lot of time at one of the houses.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the other characters besides Dominic and Mia, who are siblings, none of them have any other family to speak of that we know of. They spend all their time with these people, and they, you know, don't mention their other siblings. No one mentions their mom. Like, they're not going to go back home somewhere, because they all consider each other family. And that's something that a lot of people can relate to, who you know, maybe they don't have a family or just don't even really like their family. They go and find their family somewhere like a church. Like you go find the people who you care about and who are going to care about you in wherever you spend your time, whether it be, you know, your church or your school or your work. And so that's an interesting thing to look at, because this movie probably resonated with people more who have found their sense of family in something other than blood.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I mean, as you look at divorce rates and tons of other studies that look at the dissolution of the nuclear family, right? Nuclear families are dying, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
So yeah, it seems like this kind of narrative seems to be resonating more in our culture now. And it shows, like you said, that family is this bond that not only, you know, isn't divided by blood, but it cuts across racial and class barriers. And we talked about how class seems to be really important, and there's a lot of class conflict in this movie. And boy, this is something that's certainly relevant. I mean, race and class conflict in America is certainly something that has been around for a long time since our country.
Since the beginning.
Right? And is... obviously, if you read the news at all, just at all, you know that it's still an issue today. And so it makes sense that this is something that is sort of in our collective national conscience. And there's this idea, though, in this movie that, you know, once you're in the family, you're in, right? Even for the rival gangs. I know Johnny Tran, who's like the rival gang leader, you know, his biggest complaint at one point is like, you know, when the police came, not the police came and I almost went to jail forever, which you would think would be on. He's like, that disgraced my family is the first thing that.
And that was his biological family from what we can tell, because we think that dad slapped him. I mean, that's what I.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's the same, really the same thing with Dominic and his crew and Tran and his actual family. Like, they behave really similarly. They eat meals together. They spend time together. Like, when something bad happens to one of them, you know, Johnny says, "You disgraced me." And Dominic says, "You're embarrassing me." And so it's a lot of parallels there.
Yeah. And so it's also this idea, not only does family overcome racial barriers and class barriers, it also helps you. Family also loves you and gives you support in spite of your past, right? Because like we mentioned, a lot of these other people are coming from broken homes where there might have been abuse or where there was a death in the family, right? They all have these family issues. They don't have, you know, cookie cutter families, but they find love and they find support and they find community inside this group of this very diverse group of people. And speaking of diversity, family is also a place that allows you to use your own gifts and talents. We see that in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, again, this is a trope that appears through a lot of these movies. But you have, like, the smart guy, like...
Jesse,
right? You've got Toretto, who's you know, sexy Yoda, we said. He's the wise one. You got Brian, who is, you know, the talent. He's talented, but he's untrained. He's not strong in the Force yet.
He's the rookie.
Yeah. I like how, in this case, you used, you know... sports and I use Star Wars, so that was nice.
Oh, I was thinking like rookie cop, like.
Oh well, there you go.
I don't think in sports.
That's why I was shocked. I was impressed. But yeah, family allows you to use your own gifts in you know, your own unique ways. Another thing that I think is probably worth talking about, as to why specifically Fast and the Furious, because maybe you can even look at all of these things we mentioned and say, ah, there's really nothing unique about that to Fast and the Furious. But I think it's significant that this movie was released in June or July of 2001. It hit a few months before September 11th. And
I didn't even think about that.
A movie that is all about family and community coming together and overcoming odds and all that stuff. Obviously is going to resonate with a large, large audience after the tragedy that was 9/11. So it makes sense. Just it's interesting that this movie appeared when it did.
It's lasting.
Yeah. So that, I think that's certainly another reason why this movie, of all the other like family type movies that are out there, has stuck. And then, I mean, for all the, in this first movie, at least, really, really painful dialogue and Michelle Rodriguez.
They
and,
didn't give her that many lines, to be fair. Like, they knew that she wasn't that good of an actress.
So, in spite of all that, like, it's still a fun movie, you know, as far as it goes.
It's fun to see things blown up when you know no one's actually getting hurt. But I will say that the scene where he's hanging off the truck, getting shot at, like, suspended, trying to, man, what's that guy's name? I don't remember. It's the guy that gets stuck on the truck. Do you remember his name?
I don't, yeah,
Vince,
I can't remember.
Vince. When he's stuck on the truck and he's, like, about to get shredded into pieces on the road, that was not fun. I did not like that kind of suspense, and it made my heart rate go up exponentially.
Yeah.
But for the most part, like, it's just it's a fun, dumb movie, and that's a, you know, that's what people like to see in the summer. And then when it has a little bit of heart in it also, like, bonus, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I totally get why this appeals to people. I wouldn't begrudge people for enjoying this movie or the series or anything like that, even though it's not my own, it's not really in my own wheelhouse, so to speak. Let's, while we're doing this and we're talking about community and we're talking about family, let's Jesus juke this a little bit.
Yeah.
And, I think everyone knows where we're going anyways. We've made it fairly obvious, like a blockbuster. But let's talk about the church a little bit. I mean, as Christians, the church is very important. And I mean, the church ultimately we see isn't made up of people, related by blood. Ooh, I could really Jesus juke this and say they are related by blood. They're related by the blood of Jesus.
Oh, wow. You heard it first on Real World Rewind.
No, but obviously, within the church, we're not all related by blood. We're not even all there because we have, we're certainly not all there because we have the same gifts or the same strengths. But we're there just, I mean, in a very similar way to, or in a very analogous way to the reason Toretto and all of his gang are there is because we're united by a common love or desire. Well, I'm just going to Jesus juke this all the way. But I mean, they're united around their love for cars. We're united around our love for Jesus.
And Jesus's love for us. Importantly.
But so I'm kind of being tongue in cheek with some of this. But to be completely serious, I do think movies like this are important because, I mean, Shannon, as you know very well, I'm an introvert.
I do know that. He does not spend time around people very well.
I would prefer to
stay home.
To stay home, right? I'm just kind of like, I stay home, read my books, you know, do my thing. But I'm an introvert. Not that I like live underground or anything yet, but
you're not a hermit, but yeah, you're an introvert.
But I am an introvert, and to be completely honest, it's a struggle for me. And has been since I discovered I was an introvert, I guess, which was mostly, came about during college. It can be difficult, committing yourself to being a part of a church body because it puts you outside of your comfort zone, frankly. And I think movies like this, it even kind of nudges me as I'm joking about it and things like that to remember that, I mean, the church isn't about, you know, my own comfort or anything like that, right? It is about uniting around Christ and using my gifts as best I can to serve Christ. And so I think it can be valuable just so far as that goes. I think this is a good reminder of how important the church is in the Christian life. I don't know any thoughts you have.
Well, I mean, it's important because the church and family is not about doing what you want to do necessarily, but people who are there to have your back when things go wrong, and people that are there to raise you up and bring you down when you need to be, and people that are there to remind you of the common cause that you're all there for. And I mean, in a blood family, that's, you know, you are born into it. That's what you do. You love each other because you love each other. But in the church family, you need people there to remind you of how it is important that Jesus is what is at the center of your relationship. And it's an important thing to remember whether that family is put together by yourself or something that you have no say in. And so that's a good reminder from this movie.
Yeah, it certainly is. There definitely are reasons beyond just it being fun and big and an action movie that I think this movie resonates. And we certainly haven't even talked about them all, but I do think we're wrapping up our time here today. And I think we have just about wrapped up this episode. This does it for us. So thank you everyone for listening. Shannon, why don't you take us on home?
Thanks everyone for listening. We want to hear what you think about The Fast and the Furious, and if we got any cards or anything wrong, let us know. The easiest way to do that is by joining our Real World Theology discussion group on Facebook. Also, if you've enjoyed the show, please take a second to subscribe on iTunes and leave us a rating or review. That wraps things up for us here, so until next month, thanks for rewinding with us.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!
Do 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 do. Hey!